Hello, thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit biteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show.
Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest, returning guest, is Dr. Ian Prattis, and we will be talking about his newest book, Shattered Earth, Approaching Extinction. Shattered Earth provides both a big-picture look at our planet's environment in crisis, along with a more individualistic personal perspective, evident in his own experiences shared throughout this book. Dr. Prattis employs a skillful blending of fiction, nonfiction, and biographical narratives to effectively convey his message in a thought-provoking and reader-engaging manner. Dr. Prattis is an author, professor emeritus, ambassador for peace, Zen teacher, poet, scholar, and so much more. Through his numerous public talks and retreats around the world, he encourages people to find their true nature so that humanity and the world may be renewed. You can find out more by visiting his website, which is ianprattis.com, and that's ianprattis.com. So that, I'd like to welcome Ian to the show. Good day, Ian.
Oh, very, very nice to be with you again.
Thank you, thank you. Yes, as I mentioned before the show, the last time you were here, it was March of last year, and we were talking about our world is burning. So you've got this real passion, you know, for the environment and you know, the state of our world. So your new book is called Shattered Earth, Approaching Extinction. So that sounds rather intense. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, how it is that you know, you came up with this title? Why? What do you hope this title conveys?
Well, I think I would go back to a scientist by the name of Elizabeth Colbert. She wrote a book called The Sixth Extinction in 2014, and she made it very clear that the difference between the five prior extinctions on planet Earth and the imminent sixth, that's ours, is that the present extinction is due to humans as the agents of mass destruction. And she makes it very clear in her book that the acceleration of the sixth extinction is mainly driven by the consequences of carbon dioxide pouring into the atmosphere along with all the other greenhouse gases. And she makes a really very good point that the world is changing faster than species can adapt, and that includes Homo sapiens. Now, are we likely to rein in our economic growth, our carbon emissions and toxic pollution? And there's a wry one sentence from Paul Ehrlich in 2014. He says, in pushing other species to extinction, humanity is busy sawing off the limb on which it perches.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the way that we, you know, the rate of extinctions happening, you know, in various species, it seems, I mean, I just can't fathom when we're talking about thousands of, you know, extinctions mm-hmm. going on, you know, I'm not sure what the rate is, but I mean, but it's to me, it seems like it's very intense. So now, with the shattered earth aspect, can you talk a little bit about you know, the fact, you know, kind of where we are in that process of being shattered, and are we to the point where, you know, the pieces can't be put back together?
Well, I will admit that it was difficult for me to write this book about darkness and extinction. I had to roll myself into the dark side for a little bit, and really try to face extinction with bravery and a developed consciousness. So to the best of my ability, I endeavor to follow Gandhi's principles of ahimsa, do not harm. I live very simply as a planetary activist and Zen teacher. And my initial task is always to refine my own consciousness, to be a vehicle to chart an authentic path. If I didn't do this, I couldn't write this book. And the way the book came about, there's quite a journey with that itself. 15 or so years ago, I published a book called Failsafe, Saving the Earth from Ourselves. And I write about Homo sapiens as perhaps a failed genetic experiment. And this book was the text for a television course on ecology and culture at my university in Canada. And I remember stopping halfway through the course, just stopping and looking out at all these fabulous young people. And I offered an apology to them that my generation had not left them with a healthy planet. Now, four books later, I released the book we discussed, Our World is Burning, My Views on Mindful Engagement. This was 1928, I think. And there were 16 essays, and I offered examples of how to respond to the most serious social, economic, environmental, and personal challenges of the 21st century. Now, this year, 2019, I participated in the climate strikes on Parliament Hill in Ottawa. And I happened to meet many of my former ecology students also protesting, but they remembered my apology. But it was also very emotional for me to see thousands of children shouting out for politicians to get behind the science. So on the Hill, I mused on the book, Failsafe, Saving the Earth from Ourselves, published much earlier. And I recalled that apology at the climate strike. And I was surrounded by thousands of magnificent children. I was in admiration of their strike, yet emotional and sad that Earth matters had not changed for the better. I was also thinking about the completion of my new book, Shattered Earth, Approaching Extinction, to be released at the end of October, and decided to dedicate it to the brave children of our world. And what my books are doing, I'm trying to attempt to change the state of our world. Only things have got so much worse since my initial apology. So to blaze through the fog and the difficulty, I guess I went over to the dark side with my latest book. And a brilliant reviewer of this book remarked at the end of her testimonial, "This book is dark, it is bone-chilling, it is captivating." That's a pretty good description.
That's a darn good one. Well, because it obviously achieved the result you had hoped for.
Things hadn't gone as I had hoped. I remember when I was in India in the 1990s, I met a guru there, and he knew what I was concerned about with the climate and the future of the planet. And he just said to me, you know, if we could only get everyone meditating by 2%, that will make a change. Only it didn't happen, not even 2%.
Yeah.
So, you know, he gave me some encouragement, but that there's nothing to show that. Whether things can turn around fast at this stage, it's a bit of a shot in the wind.
Yeah, we know that was, you know, that was one of the things that, you know, kind of was thought-provoking for me, was, you know, in the that right now everybody is always talking about what to do to prevent, and it's good, having that discussion is good, but no one is talking about what it seems to be the inevitable trajectory that we're on, how to deal with what's up and coming.
Well, yes, the thing is we have a intertwining between the corporate oligarchy, the political structure, and humans. We have to be really clear at the moment. The corporate oligarchy will not budge from their greed and power, and they have already bought and sold governments. And they will certainly cut the possibility of restraint, thereby dashing the bravery of children worldwide. And the emergence of Extinction Rebellion, this is a global grassroots environmental organization that emulates Gandhi and Martin Luther King's adherence to nonviolent protest. And that's a disruption I fully support. But their target is existing political establishment at the beck and call of corporate cabals. And something interesting happened 10 years ago. A brilliant pushback was made by Polly Higgins. She was a brilliant barrister in Britain. She created a campaign to criminalize ecocide. What she meant by this, because it was aimed at the destruction of ecosystems by the carbon cabal and their political lackeys. The legal instrument of ecocide has yet to be adopted, though her idea has garnered worldwide momentum to hold corporate executives and governments liable for the damage they do to ecosystems and humanity. Now, the legal work of the ecocide movement operates as a counterpart to the mobilization of Extinction Rebellion and Greta Thunberg's global youth strike for climate. And the organizations are highly complementary and combine. Unfortunately, Polly Higgins died from cancer in April 2019. Her strong
I know. I was so sad to hear that. I mean,
oh,
I had her on the show.
She was
fantastic.
She was a doll. She's a wonderful woman. And I miss her. And her strong belief was that such a law would change the world. And she's right. And it only takes one or two countries to take it on, and then it will spread. And
right.
One of the last quips, she had a terrific sense of humor. Her everlasting quip will never be forgotten. I have a choice to protect our Earth or let it be destroyed. She was that kind of person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was very encouraged to see, her work continue, and I've, of course, follow her on Facebook and watch, that activity. So it's encouraging to see what she was striving for continue, and to see maybe even with a stronger commitment, to seeing it through.
She had built up a very strong team, and on her death, that team has just got stronger, and it's made of brilliant lawyers and barristers from many countries who are all pushing, trying to get the notion of ecocide on the as a tort in the legal system, so that when ecosystems are broken by corporations or governments, they're liable. And it's a simple, straightforward spear, and I hope it lands.
Me too. We really need that. So now, you mentioned, as far as three factors that are kind of forces to be reckoned with, the corporate oligarchy, political and individual forces. So when it comes to first of all, with the corporate, I don't know if there's a way to make people in the corporate world do, quote, the right thing, or to be for, eco responsible unless it has to do with profit. I mean, it's
that's right.
It's, you know, and you know, in one way, I can see the idea. I mean, that's kind of the basis. I mean, it's the business, and that's a lot can be done through that system. You know, it's obviously just a matter of one's corporate footprint, you know, and making that better.
Well, it really has to be more than that. There was. I came across some work being done in Australia, and it chilled me. This was a scenario that the Breakthrough National Centre for Climate Restoration in Australia, and they make a straightforward statement that we don't have a technological or scientific problem. It's a question of humanity's socio-political values. We need a social tipping point that flips our thinking before we reach a tipping point in the climate system. Now, The scientists there, they took a harder look at climate crisis than the scientific colleagues in the UN and the IPCC. And they state that the climate science projections are too conservative. So what they did, and this is what gave me shivers, they explored a 2050 scenario of extreme severity and showed that accelerating climate impacts pose very large negative consequences for humanity. And they lay out a disturbing vision of human life being extinct in a horrible manner. And they predict that between 2020, that's next year, to 2030, that there's abject failure to act on the evidence, keeping global warming below a further 2 degrees. And the way in which the scientists are looking at it, it's going to be 3 degrees of global warming very quickly. And from 2030 onwards, carbon cycle feedbacks are beyond predictions, so that by 2050, the hothouse Earth scenario is realized. And this is where you have the interaction of carbon system feedbacks driving the Earth system climate, so that further warming becomes self-sustaining. When it becomes self-sustaining, there's nothing we can do to stop it. I had to read through this stuff several times to find flaws in it, but there were very, very few flaws, because what they're showing is that by 2050, if we haven't done the work, the jet streams are destabilized, ecosystems collapse, and there's nowhere for relocating billions of people. An outright chaos is all that remains, simply because that between 2020 and 2050, it doesn't look good. I talk to politicians in Canada, they say, by 2030, we'll have got things in place. And I say, you can't do that. I say, I want to shake them. I say, look, by 2030, if you haven't got it already in place, forget it. You will be
kind of like right, kind of like writing your exam the night before, like writing your writing your essay the night before your exam or whatever. So you just can't wait till the last minute for that kind of thing. Go ahead.
Carry on.
I would say that's just one of the things I can't wait. You kind of really need to do that now. One of the things you mentioned, about that Australia, you mentioned social tipping points and eco tipping points. Now, was there a distinction? I mean, I never thought about the a social tipping point. You know, I mean, I've always, what's always in, I think, everybody's faces are the eco, tipping point. So, in your opinion, do you think are these two will social tip before eco, or is it a race?
I am really hoping.
Tips first.
And I'm encouraged by the young people worldwide, 7 million of them, went on a climate strike all over the world, and they're still carrying. This is the lead from this wonderful young woman, Greta Thunberg, who I admire. I admire this young woman immensely. Now they are doing a social change. They're trying to get their children to tell their parents, to tell everybody they know, come and support us. And so, and you've also got the Extinction Rebellion group following them. And so you've got a lot of people who are changing things, trying to keep it as safe for them now as it can be. It's supposedly always intended to be non-violent. And the XR Extinction Rebellion is based on Gandhi and Martin Luther King. But, you know, what you need for leadership, you need people with a very deep and sound spiritual essence, you know, because they can at least keep the crowds in line, especially to have non-violence as a basis.
Yeah.
And sometimes with XR, that hasn't been in place.
Yeah, and
so
there's
a lot going on, to get a measure moving. But it's the young children who are driving
it. Well, now, Ian, I have to share this. I have not mentioned this to anyone. I had a guest on my show maybe 4 or 5 months ago, maybe 6 months. Who's been on TV, and so anyway, we follow each other on Facebook, like I do with a lot of guests. One day, I saw a post of his talking about Greta Thunberg, and it was like a takedown of this self, this like insolent child, trying to tell the world, who is she? I was like, I was stunned. I mean, I'm very much with you, in my perspective of her attempt, of her, what she's doing. But that one just threw me. I mean, I had to kind of sit there and, before I muted, that aspect, because I don't want it in my realm. But I mean, it was something to think about, that there is still that kind of opposing force.
That's right. Fortunately, she has so many people supporting her. And I think because she does have Asperger's, she's single-pointed. It rolls off her, thankfully.
Yeah.
If I was in her place, I would be really upset by these people hating me and declaring how terrible I am. I don't think she cares.
Yeah,
she's got this single-pointed idea of what she must do.
Yeah, yeah. And you're right.
And
to her, it doesn't matter what you... yeah. And, that's such a perfect vehicle or way to present, to the world, to raise awareness.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to take a quick break, Ian, and I do want to invite listeners, if you want to call in and ask any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those listening in live in the chat room, if you have any questions, feel free to pose them, and we'll get to them right after the break. And then when we come back in, I want to kind of focus in on what the listeners can do as far as actions. Both I want to talk about individual actions, and then also maybe corporate kind of business types of actions, okay?
Okay.
Okay, great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, BiteRadio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,400 shows we have had over the past 9 years. Also on the site is a link to the products and services we provide: books, photography, a wellness store, and self-publishing assistance. Our show is a free podcast on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, iHeartRadio, and TuneIn. And you can subscribe for free on any of those platforms by using the links on our website homepage. We are on many social media platforms: Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc. And we also have buttons to those platforms at the top of our homepage. Our website, BiteRadio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us again. Today, my very special guest is Dr. Ian Prattis, and we are talking about his new book, Shattered Earth, Approaching Extinction. And again, you can find out more about Ian and all he has to offer by visiting his website, which is ianprattis.com, and that's ianprattis.com. Okay, with that, we're back, Ian.
Hello.
Hello. Okay. Before we go on to the individual one, during the break, it kind of struck me. You know, you mentioned that you had to kind of go to the dark side for this book. Can you tell us, I mean, because, you know, if people, you know, follow you or, you know of your work, you know, the dark side isn't, you know, a place that you frequent. So for you, was it, tell us about that experience, you know, about, you know, kind of having to get into that mindset. And then, you know, once the book is done and all over, you know, has that altered your perspective at all?
That's a good question. It's a hard question. The going over to the dark side was to really look. I went to 2080 and surmised what it would it be like looking back from 2080 back to the present, and it was all dark. And I had to write it in a way that I personally would not like to see as an outcome, but that was deliberately made dark. But when it got into part two, and I looked at facing extinction, I talked about the notion of impermanence against what it was charging against. Because we have the denial of climate emergency by presidents in the USA, Brazil, mm-hmm. Australia, and other nations, and that leaves the world bereft. And the massive cooperation required to offset the accelerating climate emergency has not appeared yet. So what's left for us? So I go deep into my spiritual practice, and I talk about the notion of impermanence, and that's from Buddhism. And impermanence expands the heart and mind so that a culture of kindness and cooperation emerges. And impermanence is not so far away from the modern mindfulness movement that most people know about. So, but I offer four simple steps to understand impermanence. The first step is that things change. Second, accept the existence of the change. Thirdly, find your composure about it. And four, use meditation and the fullness of your heart to continue. Because when we recognize that our present form of civilization is dying, we will recognize that despair and denial will do us no good. We need to rely on our practice of mindfulness and community activism to provide a measure of sanity. Martin Luther King devoted most of his time and efforts to build the beloved community as the strength to break through racism in America. So with spiritual practice and community activism, instead of denial and despair, a space opens in our mind for lucidity and steadiness to propel our species to live differently. When such a community walks with us, fear dissipates, and the dreadful despair and suffering recedes. Now, such a future on Earth requires a mass awakening of attributes that run counter to the ecology of greed. It requires a candid acceptance that our global civilization in its present form is coming to an end. So such an acceptance of our reality on the planet enables understanding of environmental collapse and extinction, and we take the steps to be different, to take different measures. And as individuals, to deal with the climate crisis by building community activism. Because when the shit hits the fan, if I can use that expression, happens, we know that the community activism that we're part of, they will be there to support us. So it's difficult. When we look at what measures can we take, what can we do as individuals, and the narrative I sort of put down is to show that the narrative I provide shows how the strategy of community building and activism in the face of extinction is necessary. This is what it takes to derail the culture of fear and greed. When we've got fear and greed, we're toast. So to truly embrace impermanence requires an open spiritual practice, cooperative networks, and preparation for community activism to invigorate the values that serve humanity. So the required global response to implement some form of the Marshall Plan or the Green New Deal, both of those are not enough. We need political leaders to suddenly become brave and make bold choices to connect rather than separate. I wish all our prime ministers were like the Prime Minister of New Zealand, that wonderful lady there. So in the looming vacuum, deadly forms of climate emergency will certainly crash down all over the planet. But the organization of community building and community activism provides local support with a strong view of impermanence. There may well be disaster in our faces, but there's also solidarity in community activism. This is Martin Luther King's beloved community, no less. That's what I'm shooting for, and that's what I'm advocating.
Okay, wow. Yeah, well, you know, I didn't know you were going to go. No, I mean, community activism, raising awareness and building the community. That is something that everyone can do. I mean, and
that's right.
It's no matter where you are. I mean, whether your community is, you know, a skyscraper of apartments or, you know, or your city. So it really doesn't matter, does it?
No. No.
Yeah.
And it's essential and it works. I think of the where I live. I live on a crescent, which is off a crescent, So we're right in the middle. And I suppose we have an underground economy because we all have different skills and we just share. And not a dollar exchanges. And that's a community activism neighborhood, which is just partly because of my wife and myself and how we do things.
Right.
And we just invite other people to be part of it. And it
well,
works
you know, and
beautifully.
Also, if you think about, you know, whenever there has been a natural disaster and, you know, people end up having to rely on others, it's that the degree of success in those areas where, you know, there's a very strong community. So, I mean, it doesn't, no nation state or, you know, even global assistance can really beat that local network that hopefully would have already been established.
Yes, yeah. There's one other aspect that I make in the book, looking at ancient wisdom and indigenous ways. And that is a lot of that is from my own experience with ancient wisdom and how it enabled my heart and mind to expand. And I personally absorbed the significance of the Earth Mother a long time ago. And I saw clearly how humanity mm-hmm. neglected the basic respect for all that sustains us. Because, you know, indigenous cycles of harvesting the earth were based on an ethic of planning 7 generations into the future. Such mm-hmm. an ethic is not found in modern society. So indigenous wisdom the world over knows that protecting the earth is primary. So this present era of climate crisis and extinction, made up of greed and all of that, doesn't surprise them at all. And as an anthropologist, I was fortunate to encounter many First Nations storytellers across North America. And their poetic recounting of myths and history had a deep impact on how I thought and wrote. I would say that without poetry, cultures implode. And I finish the book with a poem drawn from ancient wisdom. I'm not going to tell you about that. You're going to have to read it for yourself.
You got to say something.
That's a little gem right at the end.
Yeah. There you go. That's called a tease. And a real good.
Yeah, yeah.
So now, overall, what are you going to, and I know that you say you really want to, raise awareness and create that, groundswell of awareness and support and action. How do you feel that this book will assist in that?
I'm hoping that it will lay things out just as it is, because young people, they don't want sugar coating. They want things as it is. Then I'm showing how it can change, what it needs. All my grandchildren have got this book. And there's a young boy, he's 14. It's his birthday today. That's his birthday gift from me. And he will gobble it up. And,
yeah.
I'm just trying to get through to many young people, because they will then share and let it go on, and say they can see that there is at least one adult that they know who is on their side.
Right.
The children are doing it in ways that just blow me away.
I'm amazed too. I mean, with the tools of communication of today, a lot of the young ones are growing up, with technology at their fingertips and communication at their fingertips. And so, they see examples of other kids doing it. And it's like, well, if they can do it, why can't I? So I think that's
wonderful. Most of the leaders are young women, young girls, 14, 15, 16. It's the young girls leading. I was asking the kids who were up on the Parliament Hill in Ottawa. I said, "Well, how do you organize this?" And they say, "Oh, well, she was in charge, or she was in charge." It was young girls doing it. And I bow down to them. One last thing I would like to say about Greta Thunberg. I recall her stinging rebuke at the New York City Climate Summit in September 2019. Now, America's president made a brief appearance in the audience. And after a few minutes, he left, and he walked in front of where Greta was standing. She was not smiling. Her glare was one of scorn for all corrupt presidents, who, as Naomi Klein states, cash in for themselves and foster white supremacy and racism to protect criminally profitable actions for the already wealthy and powerful. Now, that last line, why protect criminality and their profitable actions for the already wealthy and powerful? That is going to go in time.
Her. I mean, when they say, you know, picture's worth 1,000 words, that one of hers was worth 100,000.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, and that's great because it's it just tells everything, you know, and so that, you know, there's just no doubt. Exactly what that picture is saying. So, and I think that's great because that, again, it seems, I mean, that's clear communication, you know, that people are going to be able to get and understand.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Yeah. I mentioned that the poem I wrote that's at the end. I was on a cross-country canoe trip all the way across Canada. And what I wanted to do with the poetry I wrote was to leave a document about Canada's wilderness for my grandchildren so they would be inspired by Mother Earth and understand the meaning of forests, mountains, and forests, and riverways. I also wanted to weave in the wisdom of the elders to speak about Canadian waterways, mountains, and forests from the reverence of First Nations. And the response from my grandchildren was, you know, right on, Grandpa. that wasn't too bad.
So I'm surprised they didn't invite themselves along to you know, help add content to it. So.
Well, they have been doing that. They've been doing the climate strikes in Scotland. And their parents got in touch with me to say, Dad, can you talk to our kids so that they don't take time off school on Fridays? And I said, don't you have any idea where they're getting it from? And the best thing you can do is get behind them, support them, encourage them, because they are really the leaders.
Right, yeah.
So,
that is funny.
So in small
pockets, they were definitely going to the wrong place for that.
Yeah,
they were probably going to, you know, no. Well, you know, and it does seem, you know, it's like kind of every other generation, you know, there's that hope and inspiration. But again, I'm with you that, you know, it's interesting because, you know, this is today's crop, today's youth, and their awareness seems to be about as intense as the eco challenges in dire
consequences.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of like they're matched.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there are 15 young people. They've got a court prepared with the Canadian Parliament, that science-based climate recovery plan has not protected their future. And the David Suzuki Foundation really helped them out with this, but that's 15 young people taking the government of Canada to court. You know, and just basically, okay, no more poisons into the atmosphere. Different use of energy, and these 15 kids are doing it. You know, I would never have thought of doing that when I was their age. And I can just bow down to them. And I'm very pleased that the David Suzuki Foundation, really, the legal free assistance was supplied by them. They got media relations, interviewing skills training, all this kind of thing, so that the kids are educated about how to go about this. And whatever the outcome is, it will make a big splash. Okay, 15 children taking the Parliament of Canada to court because of inadequate attention
to
climate change.
Right, right. And, so, and they're right. That's the thing. You know, they're right about it. So,
And half of the kids are Indigenous and the others are non-Indigenous. So it is a great... great mix.
Good. Good effort.
So,
yeah. Well, that's great. Well, now, if people wanted to get in touch with you, either to talk about the book or maybe you do speaking engagements too, so, you know, if anybody's interested in contacting you, what's the best way to go about that?
Probably Facebook through Messenger, because most people are on Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And at least my stuff.
Or at least a billion or so.
That's probably a good way. Or they could try me by email. iPractice@bell.net. iPractice@bell.net. Either way is
fine. Great. Okay. That sounds wonderful. Well, I know that. I follow you on Facebook, and I love the posts that you put up. It's always very interesting reading, so people would do well to join you there. So, well, Ian, I wanted to thank you for your time today. I enjoyed speaking with you. Now, I expect probably in another year and a half there will be probably that book about going across the country and coming up with the one that you're going to be working on next. You know, probably another year and a half maybe for that one.
Well, we'll see. But it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Again, everyone, you're welcome. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Dr. Ian Prattis. We've been talking about his new book, Shattered Earth, Approaching Extinction. Again, you can find out more about Ian and his many books by visiting his website, which is ianprattis.com, ianprattis.com. And everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Remember, our show is available as a free podcast from Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. To follow our show, visit our homepage at byteradio.me and select the platform you use most. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ByteRadioMe. Until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.